abandoned station was located at milepost 50 of the Denali Highway. Flying to the east, a helicopter located the bodies approximately 8 miles from the vehicle. It appears that this, as if the Olrens had attempted to drive from Campbell to Paxson when their vehicle apparently became disabled.
There was some evidence that they had tried to rocket back and forth and and get it unstuck, but they were not successful. And from that point, they attempted to walk and along heading east towards the McLaren River Lodge, and they walked a distance of approximately 8 miles, and they were about a mile from the lodge is where the bodies were actually found. The temperatures in the Paxson area have been in the 45 to 60 degree below zero range the last 10 days to 2 weeks, and from what the troopers saw there today, it appears that they just died from exposure.
3, 3, 2, 1. Judge Ross's remarks capped a sometimes confusing four-hour hearing where World Plus owner Jeannie Bonham defended her company. She says she made 400% profit on tickets by buying airline miles in volume. Bonham's description of her business, however, contradicts earlier testimony, and despite repeated questions from both Judge Ross and Attorney James DeWitt, she couldn't produce an inventory supporting her current claims, nor the names of the coupon clearinghouses she says owe her millions. The one broker Bonham could recall, Scott Mitchell, denied owing anything to Bonham when the court contacted him by phone. Outside the courthouse, Bonham said his denial proved nothing.
Every asset I tell them I have, they get on the phone like today and they call Scott Mitchell in the courtroom. Scott Mitchell has been sued by Delta Airlines. He is not. He perjured himself, but he's not going to state anything on the phone. That puts him in a bad light. That puts me in a bad light with him. I absolutely won't. Every time I mention any names to these people, this is their plan.
Bonham tried to nip Monday's hearing in the bud by asking for a new trustee, but she filed the motion in the wrong court and Judge Ross denied it and put Bonham on the stand. But Bonham says her efforts at reforming World Plus under a new trustee haven't ended.
I filed that motion and it happens immediately. It's taken out of bankruptcy court and put into judicial court, federal judicial court, and that's what I'm going for. As far as I'm concerned, there's just too much of the good old boys in this club here.
For his part, Judge Ross called Jeannie Bonham probably the greatest saleswoman in America for drawing so many distinguished people into what he believes was a pyramid scheme. There are some 1,200 investors scattered across some 43 states, including prominent Fairbanks lawyers. But Ross says investors who expected 20 to 50% profits on their money should have known better. That rang true to investor Angie Kuykendall, who bought into World Plus a week before it folded.
The moral of the story is exactly what the judge said. The 50% return is ridiculous. You know, that's just greed, thinking that that's even possible. I think there's a lot of people maybe that supported the other side just out of a last hope, just because they invested so much money. And granted, Chapter 7, you know, you might as well forget it. I think they were just maybe hanging on a thread that they might get some of their money back.
Kuykendall says she believes the judge's decision to dissolve World Plus is fair. Now trustee Larry Compton must determine what assets, if any, Bonham has to spread among the 1,200 investors. But if Judge Ross's suspicions prove true and Bonham was running a pyramid scheme, Compton says it widens the scope of his investigation.
Well, it allows me to go back and trace the activity of the investors' money from the beginning and look for money that could have been transferred or property that could have been purchased that are no longer possibly owned by Raging Bonham. And there is no statute of limitations as far as if fraud is involved.
Bonham may or may not have a lawyer. Seattle attorney Larry Feinstein represented her Monday, but he isn't licensed to practice in Alaska, and Bonham only got the green light to sell a motorcycle to pay legal fees Monday. but there's no doubt there will be plenty of court time ahead for the one-time owner of World Plus Incorporated. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Since 1978, the federal government has sent funds through the Bureau of Indian Affairs to give Native American youngsters a hand up. The so-called Johnson O'Malley monies help Native children gain learning skills they'll need in kindergarten. They put Native cultural programs in schools and provide tutoring for junior and senior high school students. Statewide, Johnson O'Malley helps over 30,000 children. Fairbanks has the second largest program in the state, run by the Fairbanks Native Association. FNA's executive director, John Regitano, says Johnson O'Malley does a lot by putting parents in the place of government.
It is really run by the parents of the children. There's a parent committee that determines how the funds will be spent, if they're for tutorial programs, if they're for cultural clubs, if they're for preschool. And then they oversee them through the entire course of the year. So it's been very effective, I think, as a result of being directly in the hands of the parents and the children.
Monday, for the first time in 18 years, the Fairbanks program shut its doors. Regitano said money simply ran out, and he was forced to lay off a half dozen staffers. The Bureau of Indian Affairs administers Johnson O'Malley. It faults Washington's budget impasse. Bob Pringle runs BIA's educational programs in the state, and he says only the first continuing resolution sent any money from Washington to the states. That money was minimal, and since then, the well's been running dry, not just for Johnson O'Malley.
It's all federal programs that have been suffering, and the feeling throughout the contractor grantee country is that of initiating layoffs. Major contractors throughout the state who hire hundreds of natives have been contemplating layoffs as a result of the federal government's indecision on funding programs.
Pringle's been counseling contractors to be patient and to hold off on layoffs. He's certain that Washington will settle the impasse and that money will flow again. But John Regitano is not so sure, and he isn't sure the problem is in Washington. FNA's program costs about $300,000, but it's seen only a $29,000 check since the new funding year started back in October. Since then, Regitano's been using carryover money to pay staff. Last week, his reserves ran out. He doesn't believe the problems between Congress and the President, both of which have included Johnson O'Malley in budget proposals, and since FNA's other federal funding sources have not withheld money, he believes this is an agency problem.
I'm viewing it as a temporary shutdown at this point in time that is directly related to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and I can't get enough information to tell if it's the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. that's causing the breakdown, or if it's Albuquerque, which actually oversees distribution of funds for the nation's tribes, or if it's BIA Anchorage, which actually oversees distribution of all education funds for Alaska.
Whichever it is, Regitano says it's hurting parents and children. BIA's Pringle says an additional check has been sent, enough to open the preschool's doors again and to put tutors back to work. But Regitano says he hasn't seen it and says he can't bring back his staff when there's no way to pay them. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. It's the first time Alaskan Republicans will have the first word, and it's the very first time a raft of Republican candidates for president have even thought of coming this far north. This fall, Pat Buchanan, Alan Keyes, who has come twice, Phil Graham, and Elizabeth Dole, representing her husband, all came a-calling. To the Interior Republican Party's secretary, Bonnie Williams, it has made a world of difference.
Because people up close and personal, of course, are different from what you hear and see on television. You find out something different about them when you meet them face to face. Even just hearing them speak in person is different than hearing them speak on TV.
Williams also thinks the straw poll will attract more than the usual number of people this weekend. She says they'll come to voice their opinion on candidates, but they will stay for the rest. They'll elect precinct officers and delegates to the district convention, and Williams says they'll begin the process of developing the party's platform.
That starts at the precinct caucus level. It's I and my Republican neighbors deciding what we think the Republican Party stands for.
Without a strong process at the grassroots, Doris Lenig, president of the Fairbanks Republican Women's Club, says the people lose control of their own organization at state and national.
Everybody goes down there with their own agenda. And as far as I'm concerned, when they've done that, it's you never know who to support because you don't know where they're going to come down on any important issue.
The individual's vote, cast this weekend, Lenig says, will play a role in molding Republican politics for the coming year. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
For the past 12 years, Iditarod race officials have demanded that before rookie mushers can compete, they must run a minimum number of miles in qualifying races. Race director Joanne Potts says the demand was started out of concern that a musher might run the race with a lack of experience in long-distance dog mushing.
There's a lot of things he doesn't have any experience doing. He doesn't have any experience being involved with other teams on the trail or in checkpoints. A lot of times they didn't have experience cooking for their dogs and feeding them out, you know, out away from their home camps. So those are just some of the things that the board was looking at when they put this qualifier thing in.
Potts says that the ruling has been very important for the safety of mushers and their dogs. Meanwhile, with the lack of snow and cancellation of several mid-distance races in Alaska this year, Yukon Quest officials have decided to waive a similar rule for this year's Quest. Race manager Barry Emmett says they're looking at different criteria for entering this year's 1,000-mile race from Fairbanks to Whitehorse.
We don't feel that a musher should be penalized because Mother Nature didn't put snow down there for them. I mean, are we expecting them to fly down to B.C. where there's snow or fly down to Montana? I mean, they could have a race now in Kentucky, for Pete's sakes. They got more snow than we've had up here.
Emmett says that it just isn't logical for a musher to be forced to run a race that could be dangerous for them or their dogs. The decision on whether rookies can enter this year's Quest is instead being based on their previous mushing background, not only race experience. What races or expeditions the musher has been involved in, what kennel he's working with, and what other mushers know about his experience are all looked at carefully before Quest officials allow them to compete in this year's race. Wendy Royal, head veterinarian for the 1996 Yukon Quest, says that with the lack of snow throughout Alaska this year, Quest officials have had to be more flexible in determining whether rookie dog drivers will be able to participate in this year's race.
We obviously want to make sure the people that enter the race are qualified and experienced enough for the race, but this year, because of the poor trail conditions and the fact that a qualifying race isn't being available to everybody, it's only been reasonable to rethink that.
Among the qualifier races that have taken place, officials have made several accommodations, including dropping the number of dogs a musher may take and additional mandatory gear such as snub lines and extra snow hooks. Race officials for both the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest have yet to decide on any other major changes in this year's rules, including limiting the number of dogs the musher may leave the starting line with. But all agree that both of Alaska's premier sled dog races will go on, regardless of the lack of snow on this year's trails. In Fairbanks, I'm Roger Leff.
Three, two, one. If your business needs a way to chart inventory, keep track of clients, or schedule employees, there may be an inexpensive way out of your problem. Dr. Peter Noki has for years now assigned to students real-life problems that plague small businesses or government agencies. These problems, says Noki, are the kind students don't meet in the classroom.
Because if the professor says, do this, that's the requirement. They don't have to argue about it. But with these projects, if they got 15 weeks, the customer says, okay, here's what I want. They say that in the first week or so. And then about the seventh week, they see what they're going to get, and they say, hey, wait a minute, what I really want is... And then they change the requirements and screw everything up.
The experience, says Noki, gives students an entrepreneurial spirit and makes them more attractive to corporate recruiters when it's time to enter the job market. They also learn teamwork. Noki accepts only 4 projects for a semester, then he breaks his 20 or so students into teams to work on each assignment. Students have designed software that decodes and processes data from rockets and organized police schedules. In fact, the North Pole Police Department still uses a scheduling program designed by UAF students 2 years ago, says dispatch supervisor Donna Brunier.
All we have to do is input our schedules, our shift changes, our people, plug those into the program, and the program does everything else for us. We do it by month, and it puts the people in. It puts them in the shifts they're supposed to be in, catch any errors that we might have made in doing that month schedule.
Students can work in either the IBM or Macintosh environments. One of their chief limitations, says Noki, is time. Students only have 15 weeks to create and install the software, so they can't make another Windows 95. But considering the time students do put into projects, Noki estimates customers are getting a good deal.
Let's say that the student team spends something like 700 hours for 5 students to do this. The going rate for programmers tends to be about $20 an hour is a fairly good estimate. So that 20 times 700 is $14,000. And then that's just for the salary, so if you have overhead. So I figure the customers for these packages are getting something in the order of $20,000 worth of custom software development.
Those interested in getting this free customized software need to contact Noki by January 17th. His email is ffpjk@aurora.alaska.edu, and his phone number is 474-5107 in the mathematics department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Runcorn's murder. 3, 2, 1. San Diego Police Lieutenant Glenn Breitenstein says despite an all-points bulletin, Paul Bradford Kane remains at large. The 24-year-old's electronic pager was found in Runcorn's hotel room, the site of the murder, and Kane was staying at a YMCA a block away. Police issued a warrant for Kane December 22nd. He comes from York, Pennsylvania, but Breitenstein says there's a good chance the suspect has fled to Mexico. Breitenstein says producers for the television show America's Most Wanted interviewed San Diego police for a segment on the murder. Publicist Ivy Van Allen says America's Most Wanted is interested in the case, but she doesn't know when or if they'll air an episode on Runcorn's murder. The 73-year-old Runcorn was found beaten and strangled to death in his San Diego hotel room December 5th. He was visiting friends and preparing to attend a conference. Runcorn earned worldwide recognition for his pioneering work on plate tectonics. Runcorn began teaching at UAF in 1989, as the Sidney Chapman Professor of Natural Sciences. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
With federal workers back on the job Monday, employees are expecting to receive paychecks soon. For many, it's been too long since payday. But area banks are prepared to help out workers having trouble paying bills. On Friday, KeyBank announced it was lowering interest rates on unsecured personal loans. Spokesman Bill Mershell says the 14.5% loans were targeted for people having trouble making ends meet.
In our case, it would be an individual whose bank is perhaps not being that flexible, or this serves as just a reminder to our current clients, or really to our telephone sales force, that there's an option to a customer who calls in with a problem.
Michelle says the bank offers the personal loans to people who've not considered using borrowed money to get through a tough time. But other bankers say federal workers with good credit needn't resort to borrowing money. Leslie Ellis, president of Anchorage-based Credit Union One, says since many of their customers are federal workers, they've arranged for some special allowances.
If the members have loans at the credit union, we are allowing them to extend their payments 30 days or longer, depending on the circumstances. And then if the members receive, receive federal payroll checks, that is a direct deposit that's recurring, we're allowing them to overdraft up to that amount, and we're not charging them any fees for that.
Credit counselors recommend that anytime people hit a problem making loan payments, that they tell their bankers. Many lenders in Alaska are allowing borrowers to defer payments, waiving late fees, and making notes in their files that the problems aren't caused by the borrowers themselves.
What it really amounts to is that these are our members. They've been members, loyal members of the credit union for a long period of time. We're very sympathetic towards them. We know that what's happening is beyond their control. We don't want to see they or their families suffer as a result of this, and we mostly want to just be there to help them. We don't want to make money off them. We just want to be able to help them get through these hard times.
Ellis and other bankers say they'll work with their customers to make arrangements. The key is to let them know ahead of time. Workers received partial paychecks on January 4th. Officials say those receiving direct deposit should get paid again later this week. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. Scores of World Plus creditors packed a federal courtroom Monday morning. Some showed up as early as 7:30 to ensure a seat, and they seemed prepared to stay the day. But in just an hour and a half, Judge Herbert Ross decided not to liquidate Jeannie Bonham's travel coupon business, at least not yet. After being forced by creditors into involuntary bankruptcy, last week Bonham sought to reorganize her business under Chapter 11 and work with investors to get their money back. That will be hard as she faces more than 100 suits in district court by wary investors. The owner of World Plus is also under investigation by the IRS, other federal agencies, and state regulators who say she can't attract new investors. Judge Ross acknowledged investors' concerns by ordering the appointed trustee, Larry Compton, to remain at the helm of the business. Millions of dollars are at stake, and Compton says he's found few business documents such as invoices or signs of assets. He and attorneys representing clients have uncovered checks written by World Plus to Bonham's husband and his business. This prompted the trustee last week to ask the court to freeze husband Steve Bonham's assets. Monday, Judge Ross kept those funds locked up. Lawyers also found hefty checks written between investors, evidence some lawyers believe of a possible pyramid scheme. Bonham hasn't found an attorney to represent her yet, but she says she has the money to reopen World Plus, and she says the only way hundreds of local investors will see their money is if she's allowed to reopen. To do that, she must first convince the trustee that her business is legitimate. But among the who's who of Fairbanks investors who've sunk millions of dollars into World Plus, few believe she'll succeed in recouping their losses and reopen her doors for business. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Every year, more than 4,000 American women die at the hands of their spouses or lovers. About 1 million get treated for internal injuries or broken bones, cuts or bruises, and shelter managers nationwide say many more than that never seek treatment. In Alaska, the statistics are even more sobering. The rate of violence against women is 1.5 times greater here than it is outside, and Alaska Native women are 4.5 times more likely to be beaten by their mates. The state has been struggling actively with domestic violence since 1975, when the first grassroots crisis line opened in Bethel. Today, there are 20 shelter and assistance programs in Alaska, and both statutes and law enforcement are much more responsive to spouse abuse than they were 20 years ago. The bill Governor Knowles is introducing this session would up the stakes in at least two ways. It would get tougher on batterers, and it would impose mandatory training for police and prosecutors and other professionals who deal with domestic violence. Annette Coggins, director of Juno's shelter program, says, among other things, the bill would promote an attitude shift about battering.
I like to make the analogy between our attitudes about drunk drivers, say, 10 or 15 years ago. We didn't go to parties and talk about designated drivers. We didn't think the consequences were very severe if we got caught drinking and driving. And I think all of us now know that if we drink and get behind the wheel of a car, it's going to cost us a lot of money. It's going to drastically affect our lives.
Coggins says if this bill becomes law, every offender would be arrested and would face the same bail, probation, and parole conditions. Abusers would get the message, she says, that domestic violence is not tolerated, and victims could trust the law to protect them. Jean Andreen is the executive director for the state's Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She says although spouse abuse is a complex problem with no easy solutions, a strong response from the criminal justice system is at least part of the answer.
At the same time, you have to have resources available to provide the support and the education that's necessary for the victims in order to really effectively break that cycle that's happening.
The governor's bill would require police to give victims of violence more information about their rights.
What currently is given to a victim is good information, but it's minimal information. This bill would allow much more in-depth written information to be given to the victim, so the next day or 2 days or 3 days later when she's out of the initial crisis, she will be able to read that information and have it available as a resource.
Anchorage Shelter Director Heather Flynn also supports the governor's legislation, but says it must be funded adequately to be effective now and years from now.
So I do hope that whatever training programs are developed so that they can be utilized over and over as new people come into the system and they can be used for retraining, because training one generation of police officers or court officials this year or next year doesn't help much 5 years from now when you have a whole new crop of village public safety officers and magistrates who are expected to uphold and enforce these laws.
Council Director Andreen thinks the governor's bill has a good chance of becoming law as long as it doesn't get caught in political maneuvering at the end of the legislative session.
But it is my sincerest hope that this bill, people will see, be able to see once they look at this bill just how far it will help Alaska go in breaking the cycle, and we'll be able to get it through in the next 4 months.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
He made a stand and he showed people how to stand up for themselves, because I consider myself poor, but I'm making a stand for myself so that I can make it to where I want to be.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming, you don't need no baggage. Just get on board.
It takes a lot for someone to stand up for everybody. You know, he took his whole life and put it towards something he thought was important. I think it takes a lot of guts for someone to stand up to the world like that and show everybody that it is important that you can make a change.
I mean, it's gone down. Racism has gone down a lot. But, like, if you go back, like, where I'm from, I'm born in Alabama, and like in Piggly Wiggly and all them other stores, they still have black and white sinks and stuff, and they still got the black and white bathroom sign up there. I mean, it's different now, they have ladies, and but it's still up there. So
it's not that the problems aren't here anymore, it's not they're not present anymore, it's just that they're not as rampant, they're not as noticeable, they don't happen as often.
I think it's still there, if not even more. It's just not as open as it used to be. I mean, like, whites won't go up and tell a black person that they don't like them or call them some names or something. So I think it's held back so much that it builds like tension, so it gets worse. It's the way you're raised and the barriers that you really don't even know they're there, but you live by them and you just don't see them until something like this comes and you just start listening to what other people have to say. I mean, and just it opens up your mind and it opens up your heart too.
only thing different in us is this color of our skin.
Our cultures.
We're all human beings. Yeah. We're all Americans. There shouldn't be any differences. Mm-hmm. We're all similar.
A lot of people do blame each other, and if you keep blaming each other, you're not going to get anywhere. It's just going to keep, it'll be a continuous cycle. Oh no, it wasn't my fault. I can't do anything about it. You can do something about it.
I just make a big point of, like, when somebody will use a derogatory term, faggot, or something like that, I just say, hey, that's not cool with me, and I'd really appreciate it if you didn't use that term.
The real test of tolerance is being tolerant of things that really disgust you. And while, you know, racists ought to be tolerant of blacks or Koreans or whatever, we have the same obligation to be tolerant of racists. I think it's kind of an essential paradox.
People get
if you can change yourself and you can see what other people are saying and you have an open mind, then when you have children, they'll have an open mind. It'll work better, because you can't change nobody else what anybody else is feeling. You can only do what's inside your heart.
Stand, and he showed people how to stand up for themselves, because I consider myself poor, but I'm making a stand for myself so that I can make it to where I want to be.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming, you don't need no baggage. Just get on board.
It takes a lot for someone to stand up for everybody. You know, he took his whole life and put it towards something he thought was important. I think it takes a lot of guts for someone to stand up to the world like that and show everybody that it is important, that you can make a change.
I mean, it's gone down. Racism has gone down a lot. But, like, if you go back, like, where I'm from, I'm born in Alabama, and like in Piggly Wiggly and all them other stores, they still have black and white sinks and stuff, and they still got the black and white bathroom sign up there. I mean, it's different now, they have ladies, and but it's still up there. So
it's not that the problems aren't here anymore, it's not they're not present anymore, it's just that they're not as rampant, they're not as noticeable, they don't happen as often.
I think it's still there, if not even more. It's just not as open as it used to be. I mean, like, whites won't go up and tell a black person that they don't like them or call them some names or something. So I think it's held back so much that it builds like tension, so it gets worse. It's the way you're raised and the barriers that you really don't even know they're there, but you live by them and you just don't see them until something like this comes and you just start listening to what other people have to say. I mean, and just it opens up your mind and it opens up your heart too.
Only thing different in us is this color of our skin.
Our cultures.
We're all human beings. Yeah. We're all Americans. There shouldn't be any differences. Mm-hmm. We're all similar.
A lot of people do blame each other, and if you keep blaming each other, you're not going to get anywhere. It's just going to keep, it'll be a continuous cycle. Oh no, it wasn't my fault. I can't do anything about it. You can't do something about it.
I just make a big point of, like, when somebody will use a derogatory term, faggot, or something like that, I just say, hey, that's not cool with me, and I'd really appreciate it if you didn't use that term.
The real test of tolerance is being tolerant of things that really disgust you. And while, racists ought to be tolerant of blacks or Koreans or whatever, we have the same obligation to be tolerant of racists, I think. It's kind of an essential paradox. Come on, see the train of the boat to leave. Come on, people. People get ready.
If you can change yourself and you can see what other people are saying and you have an open mind, then when you have children, they'll have an open mind, it'll work better, because you can't change nobody else what anybody else is feeling. You can only do what's inside your heart.
In the first 2 years of study, scientists mostly devoted their time to damage assessment, but they were also developing baseline data, species by species. University of Alaska Fairbanks geologist and researcher Dan Mann says they were filling in some pretty substantial gaps.
In Prince William Sound, there was very little baseline data on things like how many sea otters there were, what their natural population fluctuations were. In Kenai Fjords National Park and Katmai National Park, the park managers were ignorant of exactly what were their most sensitive resources that could be affected by the oil. So in 1989, it was a wild scramble, you know, running back and forth up and down the coast, trying to figure out, well, where would the oil have done most harm here? And we have to go there and look first. But first we had to figure out, well, what's here that could have been harmed?
In 1996, researchers have moved far beyond the baseline. The Oil Spill Trustee Council Director Molly McCammon says scientists are now researching the ecosystem processes that are affecting recovery, although studies of individual species are still being done where little is known.
But how they interacted with the ecosystem, with the dynamics of currents, of ocean temperature, of salinity, of predators, of things of that nature, nobody really had looked at those kinds of things. So then you start with the individual species, but then you pull into that more of an ecosystem approach to how you're really trying to figure out what's going on with them.
One study is looking at genetic damage that's being passed on from generation to generation in pink salmon, and also the impact of herring loss on other species. Community activist and marine pollution expert Ricky Ott says herring below threshold for commercial harvest are also not yet in sufficient numbers for predators.
And this is a concern because there's about 40 species of birds and marine mammals and even other fish that prey on the herring. So the question then becomes, if there's something wrong with a herring, how is this going to impact all these other species in Prince William Sound? How is it going to impact the food chain and recovery?
Scientists are beginning with what the herring eat, with zooplankton, then moving up the chain to see what impact there is from bottom to top. The forage fish studies also link with research into bird populations. Pigeon guillemots, murres, and black-legged kittiwakes are all top of the food chain species that feed on forage fish, and all are still in decline or have failed to reach their pre-spill numbers. EVO scientists are trying to find out if their problems are linked to declines among the forage fish. This same approach, looking at the very bottom of the food web to understand what's going on higher up, is the focus of a project that looks at nearshore vertebrates, sea otters, river otters, harlequin ducks, and pigeon guillemots. Ricky Ott.
And this is an attempt to understand why, to go back to square one, literally, and figure out, well, can we make some estimates of recovery once we understand what really is affecting constraining the recovery.
EVA's director Molly McCammon says the upcoming three-day conference is the third of its kind, an opportunity to promote cooperation among the scientists, resource managers, and public participants. She expects this conference will also bear substantive fruit from past and current research.
The work that's being done on pink salmon genetics, the reviewers consider some of it brilliant. The sockeye work that's been done, genetic stock identification work, they think there's just some of the best work that's being done in the world on sockeye here.
The research done by council-funded scientists may be vital not only to restoration, but in case of another spill. Geologist Dan Mann says even with double hulls, even if oil transport is done with utmost care, odds are against the tankers.
The weather's bad, the currents are complicated, and these are ocean-going ships that weren't really designed to navigate, you know, the little rocky islands going into Valdez and out through the Prince William Sound. And if it's not in Prince William Sound, we have a number of other, you know, places we could get hit with oil spills. Now, Cook Inlet is probably the most likely and dangerous place.
Mann says Cook Inlet spills would be smaller ones, but between the winter ice pack and inland currents, tankers across the state still ply dangerous waters. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. Recently, a dozen or so Fairbanks CPAs gathered to mull over how they might best serve clients who invested with World Plus Incorporated. Last month, the travel coupon business and its owner, Jeannie Bonham, were forced into bankruptcy. Now Bonham is trying to convince a court-appointed trustee she has a legal plan to reorganize and pay creditors. Complicating the process, however, are investigations by the IRS and other state and federal agencies, and worries that criminal charges may be pending. Moreover, 100 local investors have turned to the courts to get their money back, and hundreds more have organized to see if millions of dollars in investments can be recovered outside the courtroom. With tax season at hand, Fairbanks accountants wanted to anticipate the ramifications of the complex and uncertain situation. Accountants declined to go on record, but a few admit they may urge some of their clients who invested in World Plus to seek legal counsel. Meanwhile, an ad hoc committee of investors also met Monday. Committee members say they want to conform to state and federal guidelines when they formally organize. They meet again Thursday to elect a chair and get an attorney to represent them. Finally, owner Jeannie Bonham has sued television station KTVF and reporter Michaelyn Contreras for slander, saying they ruined her abilities to run her business. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Somebody recently called this winter boring and calamitous. Between the dearth of snow and the recent persistent cold, outdoor buffs aren't having much fun, and now business is booming for plumbers and pumping and thawing outfits as residents struggle with frozen water and sewer lines. Rich Seifert, who's the energy and housing specialist with Cooperative Extension, says in any other year when the mercury plummets, reaching for a shovel would help protect the pipes.
Normally you could say, well, pile up snow around the base of the house, pile up snow under the eaves, right next to the foundation, because that's insulation. Well, we don't even have that this year.
The trouble, Seifert says, is that the cold is slipping farther and farther into the ground.
There's just no insulated protection now. The frost depth will probably never be deeper in our lifetime than it is this year.
Usually there's enough snow that even when temperatures turn frigid in January and February, underground lines stay warm enough to keep the water flowing. Frost depth might reach 4 feet by March. This year, in some places, it's already down to 6 feet, and water lines are locked in the deep freeze. Russell Lynn, co-owner of Bud Hilton Thawing, Pumping, and Backhoe Service, says where there's little snow, people might try to insulate with straw or styrofoam.
The styrofoam would be the better choice there. The problem with the straw is it's something that, unless you're going to mound up 3 or 4 feet of it, you're not going to get quite the insulating value of the styrofoam insulation. They compare about 1 inch Styrofoam's the equivalent of about a foot of straw.
In addition to insulation, Lynn recommends heat tape for water and sewer pipes that run close to external walls. And for houses with wells, try a well-placed light bulb.
With the wells with submersible pumps and what they call a pitless adapter that comes out of the side of the well casing, putting a light bulb at or just below that pitless adapter, that will keep that part of the water line warmer, so it's less apt to freeze right at the well casing. It won't help the water line itself very much.
But no matter how cold it gets, Rich Seifert says people should remember to think safety first.
The most dangerous thing is always using an unvented heater that burns any carbon-based fuel, because you stand a good chance of producing carbon monoxide. I don't want to advocate electric heaters, but if you have an emergency heating option and you have access to electricity, it's always better to use a non-combustion source like electricity, because it's not going to produce any poisonous gases.
This winter's frost level hasn't reached its maximum. There's more cold ahead, and frost usually dives deepest in March. Frost watchers are anticipating an early spring low of 8 to 10 feet. Meanwhile, the Weather Service says interior residents can expect another shot of cold air this weekend. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. Opponents of bear baiting are winning battles in several western states. Of the 40 states where black bears live, only 10 permit hunters to use baits for luring bears into shooting range. Humane Society Vice President Wayne Pacelli says with recent victories in Oregon and Colorado, he's hoping to soon spread the bans to Washington, Michigan, Idaho, and Massachusetts.
In 1996, there will be as many as 4 additional states considering ballot initiative bans on bear baiting. So it really is an unprecedented amount of activity. It shows the great public disgust for this unsportsmanlike and archaic practice. We're very confident that when citizens are presented with a choice, they will certainly opt to ban bear baiting.
Alaskans may remember Pacelli from his opposition to the state's wolf control efforts. And while he says the society has no immediate plans to push for a ban in Alaska, others say it can't be far off. Opponents argue that baiting bears violates ethics like fair chase while habituating the animals to human food sources. Sandra Arnold, director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, says her group opposes the practice, but they have no plans to launch a campaign, at least not yet.
I think it is the right thing to do away with the most questionable, ethically questionable practices, shooting wildlife from airplanes, baiting wildlife to lure it in to shoot it. Has nothing to do with an overall agenda to stop all hunting and trapping. It's just the most extreme methods.
Hunters are divided over the issue. A Fish and Game survey says among hunters statewide, just under half supported baiting. But among Alaskan voters as a whole, some 63% oppose the practice. Many hunters agree that bear baiting is ethically suspect, and they just as soon see it eliminated, lest the anti-baiting wrath snowball into eliminating other practices. But Ken Vorsak, president of the Golden North Archery Association, says hunters who argue for compromise are already losing.
I don't think that's the answer. I really believe that we need to sway the public opinion, or at least give the public the facts as we see it in the way that we believe it to be, so that they understand the acceptance of these activities.
Roughly a quarter of the 1,500 black bears killed in the state each year are taken over bait, and in South Central, archers took roughly half of those. Forsak says the practice allows archers to make cleaner kills, as well as better select for boars rather than sows that might have cubs.
It's really not as easy to bear bait and as they portray it to be, so it does take a lot of effort and a lot of time, and those bears are smart, and they don't come into those baits that easily, so it's an effective method, but there's a lot of work goes into it and a lot of time.
Vorsak says he's convinced bear baiting is ethical and that anti-hunting groups are merely using the issue as an easy target in their efforts to further curtail hunting. The Game Board takes up the issue at its Anchorage meeting next week. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.